It's a great Gaither song proclaiming a great truth. Oh yes, oh yes, I'm a child of the King. His royal blood now flows through my veins. While it may not appear so, Rahab was royalty, becoming part of the lineage of the Messiah. Rahab's story occupies the second chapter of Joshua, verse 1. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, sent out two men from Acacia Grove to spy secretly, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." So they went, and they came to the house of the harlot Rahab and lodged there. The time had come for the Hebrew people to enter the promised land. Jericho was a formidable town that sat just north of the Dead Sea, and that was their first challenge. Canaanites indwelled the city. To call those people barbaric is to describe Barrow, Alaska as nippy. These people turned temple worship into orgies. They buried babies alive. The people of Jericho had no regard for life or respect for God. And into this city, the two spies of Joshua crept. And into this city, the spies met Rahab, the harlot. Much can be said about Rahab without mentioning her profession. She was a Canaanite. She provided cover for the spies of Joshua. She came to believe in the God of Abraham before she met the children of Abraham. She was spared in the destruction of her city. She was grafted into the Hebrew culture. She married a contemporary of Joshua's. She bore a son named Boaz, had a great-grandson named Jesse, a great-great-grandson named David, and a descendant named Jesus. Yes, Rahab's name appears in the family tree of the Son of God. Her resume really didn't need to mention her profession, yet in 5 of the 8 times her name appears in Scripture, she is presented as a harlot. 5? Wouldn't one suffice? And couldn't that one reference be nuanced in an euphemism such as Rahab, the best hostess in Jericho, or Rahab who made everyone feel welcome? Disguise her career choice, veil it a little, mask it, put a little concealer on that biblical blemish. Drop the reference to the brothel, please. But the Bible doesn't. Just the opposite. It points a neon sign at it. It's even attached to her name in the book of Hebrews, Hall of Fame. The list includes Abel and Noah and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, Joseph and Moses. And all of a sudden, the Rahab, the harlot. No asterisk, no footnote, no apology. Her history of harlotry is part of her testimony. And her story begins like this, Joshua chapter 2, verse 2. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country." The king could see the multitudes of Hebrews on the east bank of the Jordan. As Rahab would later disclose, the people of Jericho were scared. Word on the street was that God had his hand on the newcomers, and woe unto anyone who got in their way. When the king heard that the spies were hiding at Rahab's house, he sent soldiers to fetch them. Max Lucado describes the scene this way. "I'm seeing half a dozen men squeeze down the narrow cobblestone path to the red light district. It's late at night. The torch-lit taverns are open and their patrons are a few sheets to the wind. They yell obscenities at the king's guard. But the soldiers don't react, and the guards keep walking until they stand before the wooden door of a stone building on the famous Jericho walls. The lantern is unlit, leaving the soldiers to wonder if anyone's home. The captain pounds on the door. There's a shuffling sound. Rahab answers. Her makeup is layered and her eyes are shadowed. Her low-cut robe reveals the fringe of a lacy secret that Victoria couldn't keep. Her voice is husky from one cigarette too many. She has her hand on a hip and a dry martini in the other. Sorry, boys. We're booked up for the night. We aren't here for that, the captain snaps. We're here for the Hebrews. Hebrews? I thought you were here for a little fun. She winks, an eyelid heavy with mascara, at a young soldier, and he blushes, but the captain steps forward. We came for the spies. Where are they? She steps out of the porch, looks to the right and left, and then lowers her voice to a whisper. You just missed them. They snuck out before the gates were shut, and if you get a move on, you can catch them. The king's men turn and run. And as they disappear around the corner, Rahab hurries up the brothel stairs to the roof where the two spies have been hiding, and she tells them the coast is clear. The New Bible Commentary makes this interesting observation about Rahab concealing the spies. Reconnaissance, espionage, and deception are necessary in war, even holy war. Rahab hid the spies and misled the king of Jericho's scouts with lies. She clandestinely let the spies escape and instructed them how to avoid observation by hiding in what the mountains pitted with caves to the west of the city, the opposite of what might be expected by a posse. The deceptions by Joshua and Rahab raise eyebrows. How can they be a legitimate part of holy war? Perhaps indirect analogies of situations where deception and disinformation are right and necessary may help. Hunters use traps and blinds. Fishermen lures and bait. In sport, players will often trick their opponents by putting spin on the ball or achieving deceptive postures. In chess, a player deceives his opponent by taking the weaker piece in order to capture his stronger one. In poker, one is supposed to have a straight face. God was kind to the midwives for deceiving Pharaoh in Exodus 1:19. And by faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born, Hebrews 11:23. In all these situations, we don't accuse the participants of acting according to the unethical principle that a right end justifies a wrong means. Rather, we recognize that in such situations, deception is legitimate, not wrong. We understand. Yet I personally think the better principle is to follow what a Biola professor told Diana and her fellow students. It is never right to do wrong to do right. Anyway, after sending the king's men off in the wrong direction to search for the spies, Rahab went up to the roof where she had hidden the spies and unfolded a story that must have absolutely been astounding to these men. Quote, the whole city's talking about you. Everyone is freaking out. The king can't sleep. The people can't eat. They're popping Xanax like Tic Tacs. The last ounce of courage left on the morning train. I'm quoting from the LPV. That's the Locato paraphrase version. Okay. Her words must have stunned the spies. They never expected to find cowards in Jericho. And even more, they never expected to find faith in a brothel. But they did. Hear what Jericho's shady lady said to them. Joshua chapter 2, verses 9 through 11. "I know the Lord has given you this land," she told them. "We're all afraid of you. Everyone in the land is living in terror. For we have heard how the Lord made a dry path for you through the Red Sea when you left Egypt. And we know what you did to Sihon and Og, the two Amorite kings east of the Jordan River, whose people you completely destroyed. No wonder our hearts have melted in fear. No one has the courage to fight after hearing such things. For the Lord your God is the supreme God of the heavens above and of the earth below." Rahab not only heard what God had done, she also heeded it. She not only heard the message, she also personally placed her faith in God. Rahab found God, or better worded, God found Rahab. He spotted a tender heart in the hard city and reached out to save her. He would have saved the entire city, but no one else made the request. And then again, Rahab had an advantage over the other people because she had nothing to lose. She was at the bottom of the rung. She'd already lost her reputation and her social standing and her chance for advancement. She was at the bottom of the pit. In the practice of using earthly happenings to tell a heavenly truth and clarify it is no easy task. Yet occasionally you come across a story that conveys a message as accurately as 100 sermons and with 10 times the creativity. And such is the case with this true tale told by a Brazilian pastor in Sao Paulo. The small house was simple but adequate. It consisted of one large room on a dusty street. Its red tiled roof was one of the many in the poor neighborhood on the outskirts of this Brazilian village. It was a comfortable home. Maria and her daughter Christina had done what they could to add color to the gray walls and warmth to the hard dirt floor. An old calendar, a faded photograph of her relative, a wooden crucifix. The furnishings were modest. There was a pallet on one side of each of the room, a wash basin, a wood-burning stove. Maria's husband had died when Christina was an infant, and the young mother, stubbornly refusing opportunities to remarry, got a job and set out to raise her young daughter. And now, 15 years later, the worst years were over. Though Maria's salary as a maid afforded few luxuries, it was reliable, and it did provide food and clothes. And now Christina was old enough to get a job on her own and help out. Some said Christina got her independence from her mother, and she recoiled at the traditional idea of marrying young and raising a family. Not that she couldn't have had her pick of husbands. Her olive skin and deep brown eyes kept a steady stream of prospects at her door, and she had an infectious way of throwing her head back and filling the room with laughter. She had that rare magic some women have of makes every man feel like a king just by being near them. But it was her spirited curiosity that kept all of the men at arm's length. She spoke often of going to the city. She dreamed of trading her dusty neighborhood for a city adventures and exciting avenues and nightlife. Just the thought of it horrified her mother. Maria was always quick to remind Christina of the harshness of the streets. People just don't know you're there. Jobs are scarce. The life is cruel. And besides, if you went there, what would you do for a living? Maria knew exactly what Christina would do or would have to do for a living. And that's why her heart broke When she awoke one morning to find her daughter's bed empty, Maria knew immediately where her daughter had gone, and she also knew immediately what she must do to find her. She quickly threw some clothes in a bag and gathered up all her money and ran out of the house. And on her way to the bus stop, she entered a drugstore to do one last thing. Pictures. She sat in the photograph booth and closed the curtain and spent all of the money that she could on pictures of herself. And with her purse full of small little black and white photos, she boarded the next bus to Rio de Janeiro. Maria knew Christina had no way of earning money. She also knew that her daughter was too stubborn to give up. But when pride meets hunger, a human will do things that were before unthinkable. And knowing this, Maria began her search. Bars, hotels, nightclubs, any place with a reputation for streetwalkers or prostitutes. She went to them all. And in each place, she left her picture, taped on a bathroom mirror, tacked to a hotel bulletin board, fastened to a corner phone booth. And on the back of each photo, she wrote a note. It wasn't too long before the money in the pictures ran out and Maria had to go home, and the weary mother wept as she rode the bus back the long journey to her small village. It was a few weeks later that Christina descended the hotel steps. Her young face was tired. Her brown eyes no longer danced with youth, but they spoke of pain and fear. Her laughter was broken. Her dream had become a nightmare. 1,000 times over, she'd longed to trade those countless beds for her secure pallet. Yet the little village was in too many ways too far away. As she reached the bottom of the stairs, her eyes noticed a familiar face. She looked again, and there on the lobby mirror was a small picture of her mother. Christina's eyes burned. Her throat tightened as she walked across the room and removed the small photo. Written on the back was a compelling invitation. Whatever you have done, whatever you have become, it doesn't matter. Please come home. She did. The sun is the radiance of God's glory, the exact representation of his being. Come unto me, all you who are weary and burdened. I will give you rest. God does whatever it takes to bring his children home. Lest we think God's promised land is for a promised few, he positions Rahab's story in the front of this book. The narrator gives her an entire chapter, and she gets more inches of type than do the priests or the spies or Joshua's right-hand man. And if quantity and chronology mean anything in theology, then Rahab's headline position announces this: God has a place for the Rahabs of the world. Yes, Jesus came for the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4, for the woman caught in adultery in John chapter 8, for girls like Christina, for the sex trafficked refugees of Love, Alaska, for people like the women of Grace House. Grace House is a transition home for women who are coming out of prison, and they live under the same roof, they eat at the same table, and seek the same Lord. They study the Bible. They learn a trade. But most of all, they learn to trust their new identity in Christ. Max recently attended a fundraiser for the ministry, and one of the residents gave her testimony at the dinner. She described a life of prostitution and drugs and alcohol, and she had lost her marriage, her children, ultimately her freedom. But then Christ found her. What struck Max was the repeated rhythm of the story. I was, but now. I was on drugs, but now I'm clean. I was on the streets, but now on my feet. I was, but now. And that is the chorus of grace. And this is the work of God. And what a work he did in the life of Rahab. The Hebrew spies, it turns out, were actually missionaries. They thought they were on a reconnaissance trip. They weren't. God didn't need a scouting report. His plan was to collapse the city walls like a stack of dominoes. He didn't send the men to collect intelligence. He sent the spies to reach Rahab. They told her to bind this line of scarlet cord in the window so that they could identify her house. And without hesitation, she bound that scarlet cord in the window. The spies escaped. Rahab made preparations. She told her family to get ready. She kept an eye open for the coming army, and she checked. Don't you know she checked that scarlet cord and tied dangling from the window? Vine's Expository Bible comments, the scarlet cord is a reminder of our salvation and the blood of the Passover lamb, as well as the ultimate blood that Jesus shed on the cross in payment for our sins. The scarlet cord also represents identification. When Rahab put the scarlet cord outside her window, she was publicly identifying herself with the people of God. Some Christians say, I'm saved, but I'm not going to let anybody know about it. That's like saying, I'm going to join the Navy, but I'm not going to ever get on a ship. Jesus promised he would respond depending on whether we confessed or denied him publicly in Matthew 10:32. Check on it. The scarlet cord also signifies proclamation. Rahab was proclaiming the message of salvation, and everybody who believed her message and entered her house would be safe when judgment fell and doom came to the city of Jericho. When the Hebrews came and the walls fell, when everyone else perished, Rahab and her family were saved. Quote, Hebrews 11:31, by faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish. Her profession of faith mattered more than her profession as a harlot. Maybe your past is a checkered one. Maybe your peers don't share your faith. Maybe your pedigree is one of violence or your ancestry one of rebellion. But if so, Rahab is certainly your model. We don't drop scarlet cords from our windows, but we do trust the crimson thread of Christ's blood. We don't prepare for the coming of the Hebrews, but we do look with an eye toward the second coming of Jesus Christ, our Joshua. 1 John 3:2, dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known. But we do know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And all who have this hope in him purify themselves just as he is pure. Selah.